Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, how the prescriptive use of fentanyl has contributed to the opioid crisis. Minnesota's Attorney General says a pharmaceutical company out of Arizona encouraged doctors to prescribe a powerful fentanyl spray to patients who didn't need it. And part of that encouragement included fees that were paid to Minnesota physicians. The lawsuit has been filed even as Minnesota faces an alarming increase in deaths tied to fentanyl, a powerful opioid meant to be used for extreme pain. The incidence of deaths involving fentanyl in Minnesota in 2017 increased by 74% from 2016. So why is such a dangerous painkiller getting into so many people's hands? And what role are physicians and drug makers and you playing in that? And I'd like to hear from you. If you or someone in your family has been prescribed an opioid, particularly fentanyl, how much information did your doctor give you about the dangers of the drug? Have you struggled with addiction to opioids, including fentanyl? What has helped? So think about this morning about how whether someone in your family has been prescribed an opioid, particularly fentanyl, and how much information you got about that drug. And then talk to me this morning about whether you have struggled with an addiction to painkillers or someone in your family has, and what has been helpful. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Carrie, and it's K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest today, Dr. Tracy Green, is with us. She's an associate professor of emergency medicine at Boston Medical Center. We find her in Atlanta today. And Dr. Green, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Dr. Charles Reznikoff is with us. He's head of addiction medicine at HCMC, and he's with me in the studio. And Dr. Reznikoff, good to have you here as well.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
I know that there is black market trade in fentanyl. I don't want to set this up as the only way people are getting fentanyl and these painkillers is through prescriptions. We're going to talk about that. But I also want to understand why some physicians would feel compelled to prescribe such a powerful and addictive painkiller. Would you help give me some context around that?
Right. So fentanyl, appropriately used in a medical setting, can be incredibly helpful. And I think actually many Minnesotans have had fentanyl. For example, anyone who's been to a surgery has likely been anesthetized with fentanyl. I myself have had procedures where I received fentanyl appropriately.
In the operating
room,
you're
saying. In the operating room.
Okay.
In the operating room or under the supervision of an anesthesiologist.
Okay.
In addition, fentanyl is strong enough that it originally was intended for extreme severe pain, such as people with cancer, dying of cancer, with metastatic cancer. However, starting 10, 15 years ago, fentanyl began to be used for other types of pain, chronic pain, less extreme forms of pain, and that practice has been questioned. So still today, many people are receiving fentanyl for non-cancer pain. That many recommendations are coming out against that, and yet it's still happening. So fentanyl is part of the overall loosening of opioids for different types of pain that has happened in the last 15 years.
Dr. Green, when physicians were prescribing fentanyl 10 or 15 years ago, as Dr. Reznikoff referenced, did they have a clear understanding of how addictive it was?
Well, as we've seen with many of the other prescription pain medications, fentanyl fell in line with them as well. Over-marketing and misunderstandings of what chronic pain is and how best it responds to treatment and opioids was part of the real dramatic increase in prescribing and also our increase in deaths. It wasn't always clear what would be the best response for a chronic pain medication or for a chronic pain problem. And the marketplace really differentiated itself from pills. And with fentanyl, we have patches, we have sprays, we have different formulations for lollipops or different ways that patients could take in this medication, but also how it could be diverted and misused. But the prescribing community was not always aware of what the dangers were in the use of prescription pain medications like fentanyl.
Yeah, Dr. Arena, I ask that because when I read that fentanyl is 50 to 100 times more powerful than morphine, and do you agree with that assessment? Is that true?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. So when I read that, I wonder how well-versed the average physician was then and maybe even now in understanding what the consequences of that could be in prescribing fentanyl.
Well, different guidelines, I mean, both from the manufacturers and from FDA, there are guidelines for how to use the medication. But the challenges in the marketplace and how medical education has fallen out with respect to chronic pain prescribing isn't always clear, and it can be confusing. In this case, the over-marketing, as we saw with Purdue and other pharmaceutical companies that have been exposed over the years, it's important to really figure out what was appropriate and what was not appropriate. And, you know, in this case, perhaps the physicians may have been just as misled as the patient.
Yeah, I agree with those comments. And I have the opportunity to teach third and fourth year medical students as well as medical trainees. And in those interactions, I often quiz them on the appropriate use of fentanyl or fentanyl patches just to see how they do. And they are not properly educated on the use and disposal of fentanyl, fentanyl patches, fentanyl products, and sometimes very basic information on how patients should be educated are lacking in our medical trainees. So we are undertraining our providers on safety with fentanyl.
Where does most of the information, and this comes back to what Lori Swanson is pursuing through this lawsuit, where does most of the information for about a drug and its effects and its addictive qualities come from? Does it come from objective research? Does it come from the company that makes it? Is that why physicians might not be very well versed on this?
Physicians are educated on new drugs or new uses for drugs through a couple sources. One is through medical schools and medical training centers like residencies. And it has to sort of be in the medical canon, established medical fact to be taught in those venues. The second is by reading medical journals. And that would have to be research projects that are done and completed on those drugs. And the third is by industry. So there are many venues by which physicians learn about new drugs. However, only one of those venues will bring lunch to your clinic.
And that's the industry.
Right. So industry can be very persuasive in changing messaging and influencing behavior.
Do you agree with that, Tracy, that, and is it all right if we use first names here?
Yeah,
okay.
Please.
So Tracy, do you agree that you've got an element here with an agenda, that's the pharmaceutical company that would like to see the drug that they've been spending millions on research and marketing get out there into greater use. How well prepared are doctors for the information and, I guess, the agenda that the pharmaceutical companies will bring in when it comes to a specific drug?
Well, I think that prescribers have clearly quite a lot of education, and part of how they got to where they are is because they think objectively and critically about information that comes to them. So, and their medical schooling has always put a great emphasis on questioning the materials in front of them and the symptoms that are in front of them. So the consumption of information is in a critical environment, right? However, for medications that have an abuse potential, and opioids are clearly in that realm, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, has a risk evaluation and mitigation strategy that is assigned for any manufacturer that is creating a medication, marketing a medication that's been FDA approved, and in this case, class-wide REMS for risk evaluation and mitigation strategy, or REMS, is associated with prescription pain medications and opioids that are like a fentanyl. So the manufacturers are meant to be contributing to and required to actually be really consistent about the messaging around the risks, the harms, the abuse potential, and then also do additional surveillance post-approval, post-marketing, and report that back to the FDA. Part of that, too, is educating prescribers. They're held to and be required to educate prescribers in with a real-world use of their medications. Some have really taken issue and had concerns about how objective that may be. And this is where it's really important to keep asking about how we can improve medical education and at the institutional level and then also in the communities as this as information is presented and is it balanced sufficiently in a medical environment.
Yeah, this is a conversation, if you've just gone in on it, to understand the role that pharmaceutical companies played in the overuse, the dangerous overuse of opioid painkillers, but mostly fentanyl. We're taking note of this lawsuit that the Attorney General of Minnesota has filed against a pharmaceutical company and asking how well-versed physicians are about the consequences and the uses of these medications. But I'm also interested in your experience with this. If you or someone in your family has been prescribed fentanyl, did you get a lot of information from your doctor about the dangers of the drug? Have you struggled with an addiction to fentanyl or an opioid, and what has helped on that? Charles Reznikoff with us here, addiction specialist at HCMC, and Tracy Green with us, an associate professor of emergency medicine at Boston Medical Center. For you to join in, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at CarrieMPR, where a listener says, I'm a recovering addict who was addicted to opiates for 10 years because I was loaded up on opiates by doctors. I'm 3 years sober. Suboxone therapy and a ton of work saved my life. This will be a lifelong battle, though. And to the phones to Greg in Hudson, Wisconsin. Hi, Greg. Thanks so much for waiting.
Oh, thank you very much. First off, I hope that people saw the 60-minute report this past Sunday night. It was a scathing report against not only the pharmaceutical companies, but also the distributors. And just real quick, there was a small town in Virginia, as I recall, approximately 2,000 people, that had ordered and sold 9 million pills.
Wow.
That were these strong pain pills. But the other thing, too, I learned a long time ago, never take a prescription from a doctor without talking to the pharmacist. The doctors are getting the prescription information, but the pharmacists, boy, please, please, please talk to your pharmacist. They're a wonderful amount of use.
Okay.
And finally, shame on the medical community. And I mean this wholeheartedly. For the last 12 months, we've heard story after story after story about Prince, the painkillers that he had, the accidental overdose. If these doctors are not aware simply by watching the news, shame on them. They are irresponsible. And I'd like to ask your guests there about the responsibility that the doctors have to dig deeper regardless of their education.
Charles,
listen.
What would you say?
Three powerful points there. And, it's easy to start with the middle point and to say hear to your comment that patients should talk to their pharmacists. Pharmacists are emerging as a very valuable ally in the opioid epidemic and showing themselves to be very helpful members of the healthcare community. So speaking to your pharmacist is an excellent idea. They can be a dispassionate second opinion for the decisions of the physician. In terms of the physician's culpability in this, I take the view that this opioid epidemic, which is a terrible epidemic, happened because of five or maybe six different groups all failing in their responsibilities. It wasn't just Big Pharma. it was also the FDA and the DEA and other federal agencies. It was also the American public. It was also the insurance companies, and it was also the docs. And I do believe that docs proceeded with opioid prescriptions without enough evidence of their safety. They did it because they had to get through their day. And this was the easiest way to get through their day. It seemed to help the patients in front of them. They trusted dubious information given to them. I do not think that docs are solely to blame for this. However, they are the gatekeeper. They did, you know, the doc did put pen to paper and wrote that prescription. So docs do have a role to play in fixing this, and we do need to take some responsibility for the opioid epidemic.
Tracy, do you agree with what Charles is saying here about where the blame gets spread around, including the FDA?
Wholeheartedly, I think that all fingers are pointing to everyone holding a pen to be able to write the prescription, to fill it, and to provide guidelines and other the ability to provide care in this country, and those who consume it. A real challenge, I think, across both the written comments that have come in and from the caller there, really, we have exposed ourselves as not really understanding addiction, not understanding how best to talk to our patients, inquire about it. And Dr. Resnikoff has a fantastic teaching and written in another history in this arena. But we really see consistently that all of our agencies were not really looking at the problem, looming problem of opioid use disorder and how best to identify, care for patients, provide insurance coverage for, and the medication access to effective medications being severely lacking in most of our communities.
But Tracy, if I might, that's an extraordinary thing to take in, that you have five or six different players in all of this and everyone failed. I mean, that there was no real watchdog group that said, hold on, are we realizing what's happening, to alert the other participants in it? Go ahead.
Well, and I think thinking through, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So thinking through our extension of care, there is going to be an unintended consequence of failing to completely provide that care. So as we treat pain, we have also then created also a concern for misuse. And we had not appropriately planned for at our research levels, at our treatment levels, at our community capacity, to plan for the consequences of some of our actions, with opioids in particular, and it shows. And so we do need to catch up and think through prescribed fentanyl, but also the rise of illicitly manufactured fentanyl is a direct consequence of many of these actions and inactions.
Well, we have a lot of people on the phone lines here, so I'm going to go back to the calls to Debbie in St. Paul. Hi, Debbie. What's your experience with this?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was in a car accident in 1995 and injured my neck and back. And in the early 2000s, my doctors referred me to a pain clinic, which I attended for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, they prescribed large doses of opioids and fentanyl patches. I took them as prescribed, and they stopped working for any of my pain, and so I went into detox for a week.
Wow.
To try to stop the medication, which I did.
What was that like, Debbie, if I might ask, the detox?
It was, I am a social worker, and I've always worked with crises and families, and so it wasn't shocking to me, but it was very interesting to hear other people's stories. A lot of heroin addicts and opioid addicts who came in to have their liver levels checked. And if their levels were still okay, they'd leave and get dried out and leave and go use again. But my experience was that when I got off the fentanyl and on the Suboxone, which is a step-down drug, I'm not an addict. I'm not addicted to pain medication, but I have a physical addiction now to opioids.
Wow.
Which means that I can't stop the Suboxone. I use a very small amount every day, but I can't stop it, or I have immediate withdrawal symptoms that last for weeks at a time. I've tried several times. And I can't use narcotic pain relievers because my body no longer accepts those as a way to relieve pain. So I've had a lot of surgeries to try to repair things from the car accident.
Wow.
And it is a whole conundrum of things I have to go through. I have to
if I might, we have so many people on the phone line, but you've said so many interesting things here. I don't want to lose them. Charles, one of the things I heard in that was, I never imagined myself now having to live with a lifelong dependence on something like Suboxone. I never saw myself as an addict of these painkillers, and what sounds like a situation of overprescription for her for her injuries. How does that happen?
Right. Well, you know, I really appreciate the honesty and the candor of that call, the caller, and I want to congratulate her on the work she's done struggling with all of these issues. And the other guest mentioned earlier that we thought we could prescribe opioids for pain with no risk of addiction, or we thought that risk was minimal. Well, it turns out that prescribing opioids for chronic pain carries a risk of addiction, and many studies have estimated that risk, but I think a reliable estimate right now is that 10% of patients on daily chronic pain meds get addicted to them. And that may seem
a lot of people.
Seem like a low number, but that's actually an incredibly high number, right, considering how many people are prescribed chronic opioids. So 10% adverse risk, and it's not just any adverse risk if you're in that 10%. If you get addicted to opioids, that's a lifelong disease that can kill you and can really jeopardize your life, the quality of your life, your family, your community. So it's a very grievous adverse event that happens in 10% of the chronic pain patients. The good news, and we've heard this twice already, Suboxone, which is also called buprenorphine is the generic name for it, can be a very effective treatment for people who develop opioid addiction. So,
except that we heard from Debbie that she's going to have to take it for years, she thinks.
She may have to take it for the rest of her life, but the good news is that that medicine can restore the quality of her life. And she can relatively go on with a life as normal, plus a medication she needs to take every day, which is not ideal, but is better than the alternative.
Nikki called from Center City to say, I had a doctor prescribe OxyContin and gave me a large quantity. I was afraid it would be addictive. He said not to worry. Only 10% get addicted. Also, doctors don't usually ask about family history of addiction, which can make you more likely to have a problem. Let me go back to the phones here to Chris in St. Paul. Chris, you work in the medical field?
I do. I work in a capacity where I do see some of these addiction patients come in. And one of the things that I've observed is it seems like there's some fear from the medical community, fear of malpractice, to not treat pain appropriately. So you see very minor injuries that result in high doses of strong pain pills and painkillers.
So let me be clear here. So you're saying that doctors are worried that patients will say, you're not treating my pain. And
exactly. Okay. We have a system where people are afraid to not give proper care and have people not receive what they need.
Yeah.
And therefore, there's a result that you get people over-prescribing or giving things they don't need because someone feels they're not being treated appropriately.
Yeah, this is interesting. Tracy, I wanted to bring this up with you since you are an ER emergency medicine specialist. I was reading this study that came out of the Colorado School of Medicine in March, and it was assessing how many ER docs perceive their prescribing behavior. And this was a small study. What they found is that many ER docs are underestimating the amount of opioids that they prescribed. The lead author, Dr. Sean Michael, said, most believe they're doing the right thing. We need to directly address this thinking to be sure they aren't part of the problem. Give me a sense overall of what you make of what this study found.
Well, it's always helpful to hold up a mirror and make sure we're seeing what we need to see to make improvements on ourselves and on our professions. And, you know, we've seen shifting norms in social norms and prescribing norms through professional society, pronouncements and studies like the one that you just mentioned that help us understand and kind of nudge a profession in a different direction and take a more critical look. So it's always helpful to have studies like that. But we do tend to align. I'm not a prescribing physician. I'm an epidemiologist, so I study population-level trends. And what we tend to see is that, much like bias, it's very hard for someone to see it directly and to recognize even a nonverbal bias.
But you can
recognize them on a population level and see things that happen.
I want to understand what you just said about recognize bias. Are you saying that it's hard for doctors themselves to really see this with some objectivity about how they're prescribing? Is that what you're saying?
Indeed, and this is the place for research studies and other opportunities to really look at and align so that a prescriber can see what their behavior is compared to a norm or a profession. And we see that in some of the work that's being done following the CDC guidelines for chronic pain, for instance, and doing what's called academic detailing or having a one-on-one conversation with a prescriber to alert them to their prescribing trends. So taking information, for instance, from a prescription drug monitoring program, one of these large databases that track prescribing and dispensing trends in a state. And you can see that from a prescriber in visits one-on-one with prescribers, we have conversations with them to say, look, this is how you're prescribing with your patients, and this is how that compares to other people in your profession, and to better align. And people respond to their peer behavior and understand that perhaps they can better align the patient's goals, their patient population, and improve the safety of their patient panel.
Charles, you were going to add?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And Minnesotans should know that the state of Minnesota, Department of Human Services, has started a project in which every prescriber in the state will receive a report card from the state about their opioid prescribing, including emergency room docs, primary care docs, surgeons, all prescribers, dentists. Everyone who prescribes in opioids will get an annual report card on their opioid prescribing, comparing them to their peers and letting them know what we believe, based on evidence, is the appropriate amount of prescribing.
Has that started yet?
The first report card is the end of this year, and then it will be annual thereafter.
So it will. What you want is physicians to open up the report card and really give it a hard look.
Right.
How do I match with the way prescribing trends are going? Although if prescribing trends are distorted, as they clearly were for years, what's that going to tell you?
Right. Your point, I think, is that if all of your peers and you are all over prescribing, then comparing yourself to your peer.
Yes.
So I'm on the committee that designed these metrics, and we both have an ideal and the peer comparison and the ideal goal. And we've analyzed past data from the year 2016 and picked thresholds based on past prescribing, targeted thresholds above which prescribers are clearly out of line. And we may be, over the next 5 years, letting those thresholds change as the overall practice improves. We're trying to start somewhere pragmatic and go from there. And I will say that if prescribers ignore these report cards, there may be consequences with the state for them. So this
is not
removal of licensure to take care of patients. So there are some teeth. This is going to be a report card that will affect every prescriber in the state. And we are really hoping that this drives prescribing practice to a safer place.
Dr. Charles Reznikoff with us. He's an addiction specialist at HCMC. And Dr. Tracy Green, associate professor of emergency medicine at Boston Medical Center. To Mark in Anoka. Mark, you're a retired physician. Is that right?
Yes, a retired pediatrician.
Thanks for waiting. What'd you want to say?
What I would see and among my colleagues also, some are non-pediatrician, doctors have trouble deciding who is addicted and who needs pain medications. Patients who are addicted will seek out physicians who will prescribe, and they are very good con artists at talking doctors into giving them. They'll just, doc, you're so wonderful. You're trying to help me out, blah, blah, blah. And doctors get suckered into it. And I even had a few teenagers who wanted to become addicted, And if I didn't, if I refused, they would go out in my hallway cursing my name, saying I don't care about their pain, blah, blah, blah. And then I knew I made the right decision. But some doctors couldn't, were taken aback by that protest and will overprescribe. So you had a problem, a physician trying to recognize, is this an addicted patient that I don't know? Or is this somebody who truly is in pain? And it can be very difficult. And these addicted ones are very good con artists.
This really makes sense, Mark. I'm glad you called. Tracy, I understand that too, that patients give ratings. Doctors obviously want to provide the best and compassionate care that they can. I'm not unsympathetic to the role of the physician in this, but something has clearly gone wrong.
Yes, and for a long time we've had, recently this has been retracted, but we had pain as a vital sign guiding a lot of the feedback loops and the appropriate care of and treatment of pain as being an important guideline for how hospital care and emergency department care was rated. Physicians feeling that they needed to attend to every pain complaint and by providing a prescription pain medication. I think much like we've been talking about, some of those social norms and prescribing norms are shifting. And so, too, I think is our a better understanding of how we might be able to identify patients, talk with patients, and draw out and help us understand, are we treating opioid use disorder or detecting opioid use disorder? Are we treating and are people responding to and getting functional improvement from their care of their pain condition? This is not always, it is oftentimes an art and not a science. Mm-hmm. We don't have very good assessments. There's no easy to administer tool or test that we can administer to identify if a patient has a true pain condition or has also symptoms of opioid use disorder. But certainly we have a whole field of addiction medicine to draw from, and sometimes aligning and treating our medical students as ones who could be consuming this information, understanding how better to treat and identify patients with opioid use disorder, and then treat that problem that's in front of you, not instead of trying to perpetuate a pain misuse, pain medication misuse problem that is developed potentially from your own doing.
A call here from Mark in Minneapolis. Mark, you're also a physician?
Yes, I am.
What did you want to add?
You know, in the early 2000s, the Joint Commission on Hospital Accreditation criticized physicians for under-treating people's pain when they're in the hospital, and I think it led to also an outpatient treatment of that. And this led to the pain score, which and the and being considered pain as the as a fifth vital sign, which you talked about a little earlier. But I think this led to really an overprescribing of pain medications, and that these regulatory agencies do have a role in what's happened today.
I really appreciate the call because I wanted to bring up a report that Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill put out earlier this year, in which she was examining how the pharmaceutical industry influenced public opinion, at which patients were then influencing, right, what their doctors would do. Here's a bit of what she found. The pharmaceutical industry spent a generation downplaying the risks of opioid addiction and trying to expand their customer base for these incredibly dangerous medications. These financial relationships were insidious, lacked transparency, and are one of the many factors that have resulted in arguably the most deadly drug epidemic in American history. So Charles, this is bringing us back again to the role of the pharmaceutical industry. What would you say about what she found?
Well, I think it's accurate. I think that time will tell with even more awful detail what the pharmaceutical industry knew and what they didn't know. I think we will look back at this in ways similar to how we look back at the tobacco companies pushing cigarettes
really?
On kids. Oh, yeah. I think this is industry gone wrong. That's my belief, and I think we'll learn more and more. And we already know that it was bad. We will get more details. And I will say also that this Minnesota legislative session, there was an attempt to hold the pharmaceutical companies accountable for the opioid epidemic in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a bipartisan attempt. And as you probably know, Senator Rosen, Senator Eden, Representative Baker, many from both sides of the aisle worked together to try to get some kind of recompense from the pharmaceutical companies, and it failed. Partly, I believe, because the industry got involved in enough politicians
lobbying
to submarine it.
Yes.
So unfortunate, but that ultimately resides in the power of the Minnesotans, and they need to tell their representatives if they want to hold the pharmaceutical companies responsible. It will come up on the next legislative session. We just need the political will to get it done.
Maybe it would be important here for just a moment for listeners and patients to understand what this relationship is like between representatives of the pharmaceutical companies and physicians. You mentioned there's one element that brings lunch in. Are doctors actually, I think we have a question here about this, being paid, so to speak? Are they getting fees by these pharmaceutical companies, which then makes them more likely to prescribe these specific medications?
Yeah, this is a complex approach to influencing the practice of medicine on multiple levels. It turns out most of the time, most hospitals have now kicked the pharmaceutical industry reps out because we know they're not helping us or our patients. So you can't just come pay for lunch at Hennepin County Medical Center anymore. That's 15 years. They'll still do that, the free lunch, with influencing providers somewhat. But now it's become, they're influencing thought in different ways. They're paying for research that's tilted their way. They're essentially paying off industry thought leaders by paying them really steep fees to give speeches. Putting out advertising directly to consumers. There's many, many approaches to changing the way we think. Pharmaceutical industry has influenced guideline development, has gotten even the opioid REMS that was mentioned earlier,
yeah, Tracy
got some
about
pharmaceutical funding. So some people are suspicious even of that federal opioid guideline, because the pharmaceutical industry was in the room when that was being crafted.
Tracy, of everything that Charles just described there, which do you think is the most dangerous?
I think continuing to ask questions and hold people accountable to have transparent, public, open meetings. And I think we're learning, and we're learning to continue to ask these questions. And but I think for a long time it was the pharmaceutical representative one-on-one meetings with thought leaders and incorporating in thought leaders, sponsoring of research projects, pet projects that had always been done but had always wanted to be done but could never get funded. And that meant that there were so many people involved in the treatment of pain medicine who were somehow sponsored or had attended meetings or had attended lectures, who were influenced by pharmaceutical manufacturers, that it made it really hard to provide guidelines for pain medicine and the treatment of chronic pain, for instance, in the CDC guidelines or the National Academy of Sciences recent pain report. I've been involved with both of those, and it was a really important component that we all went through a pretty serious transparency and conflict of interest vetting process. I think now there's much more scrutiny, and it needed to be in there a long time ago.
Ramon in Minneapolis called to say, I used to work in the pharmaceutical industry for 10 years and then medical device industry for 5 years. The most important thing here is the role of the FDA approving these medications. They get money for pharma for fast-tracking meds sooner than they should. Tracy, is that true?
There's a fast-track process, and of course, FDA is critically important here. And so in looking at how FDA can better align with the current opioid crisis and approve their approval and review process, this is actually what the most recent National Academy of Sciences pain report particularly was charged with addressing. How can the FDA incorporate a framework that considers not just how does this medicine improve the pain relief of this particular patient population, but actually to consider the social impact, the public health impact of that pain medication. So importantly, I think FDA is starting to realize, as many of the agencies are, that that pain medications are more than just treating the pain of the patient. It involves a household, it involves a community, and when you provide controlled substances with that are this powerful with this degree of addiction potential in a community, we have to take a much more thoughtful approach and one that considers the social and public health impacts. And that's an exciting place that we are now. We were not there 20 years ago, and we should have been.
Dina in Maplewood called to say there are those of us out here who have been using opioids responsibly for years for chronic pain. Now it's almost impossible to get opioids. I feel like a criminal. I've recently turned to cannabis, which feels more acceptable. Charles, we are getting a number of questions about marijuana as a replacement for opioids. Where's the research on that, and what do you say to patients who ask about it?
Yeah, the research is conflicted. There are some lines of research that show that opioid addiction is more common in those who use marijuana. And as a provider for people with opioid addiction, many of them use marijuana and it hasn't affected their addiction. There is some studies also that show that states that have legalized or liberalized marijuana laws have had less opioid harms. None of this research either way is definitive. Marijuana probably, this is my opinion, plays a minor role either way in the opioid epidemic. Fentanyl, the idea that marijuana would be central to this, and we're not talking about fentanyl. Fentanyl and the distribution and the adulteration of opioids with fentanyl plays a major role in death from opioids. The marijuana is this sort of hopeful thing that seems to benefit some, may harm others, and the evidence is not out. So my general reaction to the marijuana question is, good, time will tell on that one, but let's not get distracted from getting patients into the known appropriate treatment and getting patients away from the known dangers like fentanyl.
Got it. Call here from Paul in Owatonna. Hi, Paul. Sounds like you're also in the medical field, yes?
Yes, I work in a pain rehabilitation center for a hospital in southeastern Minnesota and also a fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue clinic. And what I've seen with our patients is that insurance companies will easily pay for their opioids over and over and over again.
Wow.
But to pay for a rehabilitation program where we help people get off of those medications and then replace them with alternative and integrative medicine from a multidisciplinary background, which research shows actually can help people reduce their pain and their fatigue and their symptoms better than medications in the long run. Insurance companies won't pay for that. And then also, our society, we kind of have become like, I go to the doctor, I get a pill, and it's fixed. Whereas our approach is more of this long-term approach, but it has the results to reduce their pain.
Right. Really good point, Paul. Tracy, I think both you and Charles mentioned how the insurers play a role in this, too. Does that fit with what Paul was describing?
Absolutely. And I think this is a critical place for advocacy for medical societies and professional societies and many others in the community to demand non-pharmacological and non-opioid-based therapies for the treatment of chronic pain and access to them, including prior authorization lifting and expanding coverage for those services.
Uh-huh.
I will say that Rhode Island, and there are several other states that are starting to do this too, asked for a waiver, so to allow Medicaid to be able to pay for chiropractic acupuncture and massage therapy and for people on Medicaid with chronic pain conditions. And that has been a fascinating thing to see unfold. It's a path forward to consider.
We have a chiropractor on the line here, I think. Chris, is that right? You practice
as
a chiropractor? Yeah. Tell me what you're thinking.
Yeah, Dr. Chris Bargman.
Hi.
Yes, Dr. Chris Bargman. I practice in Edina Family Chiropractic. I've been in practice 20 years. Over that 20 years, I've seen a real shift in collaborative approach with my medical counterparts. We regularly are getting those referrals. And if you fundamentally break it down, if you look at the opioid crisis as a chemical answer trying to solve a physical problem, that's where multidisciplinary practices like myself have the opportunity to address those physical problems on a firsthand basis, getting to the source of that issue. And you do see jurisdictions such as Virginia, Rhode Island. I saw a presentation from the director of Walter Reed Medical Hospital last year, where they are now mandating chiropractic care as a first-line intervention to for example, back pain issues prior to surgery, prior to prescriptions, so that they can prevent those prescription addictions on the front side as well as the post-surgical complications that happen on the back side.
I mean, to be clear, chiropractic is not the answer to everybody's pain, but I hear what you're saying here, to not go immediately to the pain pill prescription. Yes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We regularly see patients in our practice that are not a right fit for the type of care that we offer, or it's not the solution. The problem is too far gone. And that's where we've made a great effort of building those relationships to refer to our medical counterparts, to surgeons, to neurologists, so that we can be that portal of entry physician that helps to find the answers for that patient, but not immediately jump into the prescription route to try to solve that particular pain problem.
Charles, what about this thing, which I think dovetails with what Chris is saying here about the insurance companies, and to get the insurance companies to take note of the environment that we're in and be more forward-leaning, I guess, on different kinds of care?
Yeah, it's a huge issue. The insurance companies are a huge player in this. And as people reading the papers will see, Medicare through the federal government and Medicaid governed through the state government has literally contributed to the opioid epidemic. And that has become somewhat of a political hot potato on how do we, governmental insurances, cover our patients without fueling the epidemic. And the answer to that is to approve, pay for, incentivize the right kinds of care. And that last caller was right on, that we're using chemical means to fix physical problems. And I would add to that, it really gets problematic when it's opioids to fix emotional problems, or the mix of physical and emotional problems. You both have emotional and physical trauma, and someone gives you opioids, and that is a dangerous mix.
You're saying that people are coming in for mental health issues here, and they're being prescribed opioids?
More that people with mental health issues, with trauma, are coming in with physical pain and getting opioids, and that mental health, trauma history, depression, anxiety that they carry with them has made them more vulnerable to the opioids. And they find it hard to tell the difference between taking an opioid for their back pain and taking their opioid for their stress in their life. And that's a problem.
I'm going to try to get Shayna in here in St. Paul. Hey, Shayna, hi. Just a couple minutes left, but I wanted to hear you on this.
Yeah, I work as a chemical health nurse in a community health center, and we're a primary care clinic. And so, you know, there's a real move to have integrated health care so that when someone shows up at their primary care office, whether it be with their doctor or their nurse practitioner, if that person has concerns about addiction, that we would be able to address it there in that primary care setting.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of that, that means it takes a whole team. It takes nurses and it takes doctors and, you know, other staff to really be able to support that patient and prescriber, that provider. I'd really like to see the state of Minnesota start to reimburse for certified addictions RN, because we're out there and we want to help and we want to be in the places where our patients are at, but that those services have, those visits have to be reimbursable.
Yeah,
I'd also like to see licensed addiction or licensed alcohol and drug counselors be able to be reimbursed in the primary care setting, because right now they can only be reimbursed in treatment centers.
Okay. Shayna, short time here, but Tracy, do you do that in Massachusetts where you practice?
We do, and we have quite a few good examples of that, both at the hospital levels, emergency department levels, and then also in the primary care and community health center levels, where there's been a real push to better integrate addiction medicine and behavioral health services within a primary care setting. But it is something to be thinking about it at that systems level, at that payer level, to incentivize appropriately, as your caller indicated, and then also think about the workforce and the workforce development. We are going to be living and sitting with this problem for quite some time. So we need to get good at it, and we need to be thinking about a long-term solution and investment in this care environment.
All right, Tracy, really good to have you from your conference in Atlanta. Thanks much at the CDC. Thank you. Charles, thank you. Good to have you in from HCMC.
It's good to be here.
I know we didn't get to many, many of your calls. I promise further conversations on this about the different aspects and dimension of opioid addiction.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRI NPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.